the ego swims in a sea of signifiers. And those signifiers are private. So private that the ego itself does not know what they mean. Because the signified lies in the subconscious. And it's only the sensor that determines how much of that is revealed. And even in the subconscious, because of the plurality of fantasies, of conflicting drives, of opposing frames of reference, the signifieds are inherently destabilized. And so meaning is always cracking, is always shifting, is always unstable and self-contradictory. And yet the ego mind cannot tolerate not being within a frame of reference that gives it the illusion of stability, the illusion of a context that gives it certainty as to what it wants, who it is, and what it's all about. And yet the ego also knows in its moments when it is truly candid with itself that all of that is a fiction, a delusion. And simply an anchoring in a fiction because the real is too much to be able to bear. And because the ego has only signifiers to use for its currency of communication, of exchange, of relationship, it has to pretend that those signifiers have a constant value and the same value to the other as they have to oneself. And yet, the ego knows that it is only projecting that stability of understanding, that illusion of a meeting of the minds, because monads never meet. And each ego lives in its own world of signifiers with illusory relations to their own signified. And therefore the ego is always prone to and liable to fall into an abyss of psychotic lostness in which the signifiers that it uses to anchor itself in an identity dissipate and lose their solidity, and the ego is suddenly empty of any sense of reality. So the Sangha is now screening a series of films with the title Mahabharata. But if anyone thinks that that signifier that is used as the title of the film has any relationship to the epic poem by that name, then there is a complete misunderstanding. The Mahabharata with that title, that is a video spectacle, has almost no relationship to the epic poem. This is a complete fictional adaptation by two people, Carrière and Peter Brook, that are simply projections of their understanding of reality using signifiers pulled out of that original epic poem. That is such a long work. It's longer than all of the other epics combined. Bible, Iliad, Odyssey, the Kalevala, you name it. It's more than all of them. And the narratives contained in them put magic realism to shame. It's magic on acid. And because the signifiers were written thousands of years ago in a social context totally different from our own, and written for minds that had completely different kinds of ego structures than our own, it is literally impossible for us to have an understanding within the ego frame of reference of what the Mahabharata is about. And because it is actually about aboutness, it is about how do you reestablish a reality after the collapse of a world order, right? Because it's about that liminal shift between Dwapar Yuga and Kali Yuga. But the poem itself superimposes that with the same shift that occurs and the same destabilization of meaning and being between every yuga and at the end of the kalpa itself. And all of those are contained within the signifiers that refer to a signified that transcends the possibility of being phenomenologically grasped, because it is dealing with the noumenal roots of the phenomenal manifestation. And that's why, although the core of the film, at least, and for many the poem, is about Dharma as that consistent frame of reference of law, of order, of truth, of being that remains constant through time, which is why they refer to it as the Adi Sanatana Devi Devta Dharma, the Dharma that was there for the gods and goddesses of Satyuga and remains even to the end of Kali Yuga. But does it remain? If you're no longer a god or a goddess, can you really live by the same dharma? Or do you live by remnants of the signifiers that are traces, memory traces of what is lost, not what is possible, but what can no longer be achieved? Isn't it a nostalgia for literally a lost golden age that in the attempt to recreate causes ever more of a fall? Isn't that the paradox of Dharma? And in the very attempt to consistently live according to the Dharma is totally exploded apart. And in order to adapt to the chaotic shift of circumstances at the end of a yuga, and particularly at the end of Kali Yuga, there has to be an acceptance of the inconsistency that shows up from one moment to the next, from one signifier to the next, from the same signifier in one moment to the next, and from each individual monad to the other. A total il-nyapa. And this is shown in the inconsistency of the way that the Dharma is lived, which in every case is an exception to the rule, never a following of it. And if you take the Dharma of marriage as the key, core rule that holds society together, and childbirth, how many children are born from gods rather than from humans, or from parthenogenesis, or from a male sperm dropping into a fish and being cut open and producing magical offspring? How many of these kinds of situations? How many wives had five husbands rather than one? How many situations were totally inconceivable to any kind of social organization? And so what we're dealing with is a situation in which there can be no frame of reference, no dharma that can hold the consistency of a reality that can enable an ego to feel sane. And therefore, until you rise above the ego level, the kind of anxiety that will be felt, the kind of madness, the kind of terror of going mad that the ego will suffer from will become ever more unbearable. And so in the Mahabharata, at least in the epic poem, not necessarily in the film, Vyasa, the authorial participant observer, notes that there are three modes of dharma. There is the pravritti dharma, when the world is expanding chronologically in time and social life can seem to be normal, can seem to be consistent, so that you can rely on people's word, on promises, on the sun rising the next day, on peace being sustained, relationships being stable. But that pravritti dharma, once you reach that liminal point and you cannot trust anything or anyone, including your own memory, including your own mind's understanding of what just happened, including all of the things that one takes for granted as an ego to establish oneself as a being in a world, then that pravritti dharma does not allow an ego consciousness to sustain a life. And only at the soul level, where the dharma of the soul is no longer that of pravritti, the soul's dharma is nivritti. Especially at the end of a yuga, a light goes on within the soul that says, it's time to return to God, because nothing here makes sense. It's time to return to some standard of consciousness that has criteria that can enable me to achieve the truth, the real, the fullness of what is, rather than to live in a chaotic fiction in which I cannot establish any stable basis for existence. And so the nivritti dharma, which all along was the dharma of sadhus, of sannyasis, of the renunciation of the pravritti marga, that renunciation of the plane of consistency that no longer is that, leads to the ability to then rediscover a standard by which one can mobilize the energies of will as a channel from the source of intelligence and no longer be deceived by the projections and delusions of one's own consciousness. And so this is the way out of the terror and the dread that the ego is liable to. But there's a third kind of dharma, which is the dharma that occurs as that liminal end of a kalpa or a yuga, or both in our case, happens, which is referred to as apadharma. Apadharma means that dharma that you must follow when the world is in total distress and chaos. You cannot follow the pravritti dharma, even if you want to anymore, because your karma won't allow you to do that. There will be too much suffering, too much disappointment, too much paranoia. But you're not ready to make the decision to follow the nivritti dharma. You don't want to renounce your jouissance. You're not ready to give up relationality and the joys of phenomenal existence in order to live in the singularity. You're not willing to make that shift, but you recognize that the times will not allow you to live in a way that is any longer ordinary or any longer within the possibility of creating a context that can remain stable over time. And so a gradual shift is attained by being at the viveka point, not fully making a commitment to transcendence, but also very wary of the possibility of falling through the thin ice of the ego's delusions, and therefore one tries to tiptoe through reality without breaking the eggshell of the ego and without entering into that supreme reality. But as the ice melts and that position becomes ever more intolerable, one can no longer sustain that midpoint between the noumenal and the phenomenal. A fourth dharma appears, and that we could call near dharma, meaning beyond all dharma, or ajata dharma, the dharma of the unborn, the one who is not even within the situation, the shunya dharma, the asparsha dharma, that dharma that comes when the light goes on and one recognizes that one is not the ego that is destabilized, nor the soul that's trying to find a compromise position in which it can manage without making a decision between ego and pure spirit, but that position in which the non-duality of all of those dharmas, much like the Turiya state, contains all of the three avasthas of waking, dream, and deep sleep as a single whole. In the same way that the world's currencies now being destabilized require a gold standard, the consciousness requires a God standard, requires a standpoint that is beyond the existence of a world upon which it depends, and without requiring a transcendence of that world, because the world is not real anyway. And there is no one to have to make a decision between one dharma or the other. It's that no-oneness, that space of consciousness that is beyond the split mind of subject-object duality, that no longer has to carry the burden of decision of how should I live? What does this mean? What do I need to do to be purified of the baggage and the bondage and the belief systems that are creating my suffering? But that state that is forever beyond suffering, that is all-pervading and present even in the midst of the ego's suffering that is drained of its affect by the very recognition of the truth of its unreality. It's that ultimate non-dharma that transcends all conceivable signifiers, that is beyond language, which is the trap that has created the need for dharma and the impossibility of dharma, that brings us to the root of the projection of a cosmos by the very intelligence that is inconceivable but is nothing other than oneself here and now, no matter what the condition of one's consciousness. It is that total, radical, absolute acceptance of every level and layer of that consciousness as being part of a whole that is not affected by its own contents that enables the liberation from all of those threads of cause and effect, of meaning, of logic, of the entailing of consequences that the ego mind is constantly obsessed by, and all of the signifiers that produce a sense of stability that no longer function to create a sense of safety, of calm, of a place of refuge within one's own heart, is no longer necessary when that heart has never been born, that heart has never left the original unmanifest position of the Absolute Self. And one is fully lucid in the dream and no longer has to make any decisions about how to be in any way, because all of it is a movie already shot that can be witnessed and enjoyed to the full by being in the total emptiness of that which never enters into the world of becoming. That's the nature of the self. And when one enters into one's true nature, then all problems disappear. All the illogic and all of the insanity of a world that can no longer be held in any form of sense, any form of transmissibility of meaningfulness, and no longer be held in one's own mind as a stable reality, can again be fully participated in as that consciousness, that intelligence, which by viewing it, by fully entering in absolutely and unconditionally, remains forever beyond. It's that unification of samsara and nirvana, in which no investment, either in the I thought or in the transcendence of the I thought, a complete absence of investment, but a complete enjoyment of the spectacle and the glory of the intelligence that is projecting it, is one's eternal lotus throne in which one can be forever the blissful self that is all and nothing and can wager all and nothing in this last throw of the dice that either sends us into exile forever in Maya or gains us the kingdom of heaven. May you know the peace, that comes of dropping all signifiers and all search for signifieds. And settles for the silence of pure presence in which no disturbance can approach. And may you know the deeper peace of the singularity beyond time and space, untouchable by appearances, and completely free of dreams and their effects upon the dreamer or the dreamee. And may you know the supreme peace of that absolute that cannot be conceived, that is prior even to the singularity, and can only be known through becoming nothing other than the real.